You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a polio eradication campaign is suspended in Karachi as coordinated gun attacks in Pakistan kill six vaccination workers. We get the latest from the region. We're joined by our Hong Kong bureau chief to discuss the biggest stories from the year on her patch. And we also hear from one foreign correspondent who ponders the age-old question, Marmite or Vegemite?
I had to FedEx a jar of Marmite back to a colleague of mine who was then hankering
after it. Are you being serious?
I'm completely serious. I don't know. What's a jar of Marmite? About £2. What's the FedEx bill on an urgent package? You could have bought a lot of Marmite for that Marmite.
That's Garth Bray, and you'll hear more about that later. And our senior editor, Sophie Grove, will talk us through her section of this winter's Alpino. Sophie, you've been in Iceland, haven't you?
Yes, we'll be discussing geothermal energy, fishing and knitting.
Brilliant. All that, plus, I promise you, a singing Christmas tree. All here on the next half hour. In fact, no, the next hour of Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines.
Monocle 24 News. Five female Pakistani polio vaccination workers have been shot dead in attacks in Karachi and Peshawar. The victims were working with a UN-backed program to eradicate polio, which is endemic in Pakistan. The Taliban has previously threatened to disrupt the scheme. South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party has re-elected President Jacob Zuma as its leader, setting him up for another 7 years as head of state. More than 4,000 ANC delegates erupted into wild cheers when Mr. Zuma was confirmed in the top party post after comfortably seeing off a challenge by Deputy President Kgela Motlanthe. The rand edged higher against the dollar after the announcement reflected relief among investors in Africa's biggest economy at the likelihood of policies remaining largely unchanged. ANC National Executive Committee member Paul Mashatile said the party will now regroup.
Once we are done with the elections, we will put our heads together as a leadership to build a strong ANC, because in 2 years' time we're going to national elections and we can't afford to go limping. So we will unite, we'll work together and make sure that we accelerate the pace of transformation in the country to bring about a better life for all.
U.S. President Barack Obama has met officials to discuss their response to the Connecticut massacre. The White House says reforming gun laws will be complex. 20 children and six teachers were killed by a lone gunman on Friday. The rape of a 23-year-old woman in a city bus in the Indian capital New Delhi has sparked outrage across Indian society, from women activists, politicians and students. The medical student was gang-raped on Sunday night and was later thrown out of the moving vehicle in a semi-naked condition. Police said they'd arrested four suspects, including the bus driver, in connection with the rape. The other suspects have been identified from CCTV footage. Social activist and former senior police officer Kiran Bedi said police, parents and society needed to work together to deter such antisocial elements.
I think we need to give a clarion call from the mothers and fathers. Mothers and fathers, which means you bring back parents, you bring back teachers into social role, and you bring back community and police in crime prevention role. Unless we put this package together, these crimes will continue to happen, and many, many women will continue to lose their fundamental right of mobility.
The Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani, has been taken to hospital after suffering a stroke. Government sources say he's in a critical but stable condition. The leader of France's main opposition party, Jean-François Copé, has said he's happy that an agreement has finally been reached with his opponent. Both Copé and former French Prime Minister François Fillon had claimed victory in the original ballot held on November the 18th. Correspondents say the deal constitutes a compromise between the two candidates from the conservative UMP party and brings the date of a second election forward by 6 months. UMP Member of Parliament Jacques Millard told reporters at the National Assembly that the dispute had damaged the two men.
They both suffered.
They both suffered deeply. And I think that, of course, in politics, you are never dead until you are in the churchyards. But in fact, I think that their necessity today for them is to restore the credibility and to work in his direction.
Egypt's public prosecutor has resigned under pressure from his opponents in the judiciary. The move deals a blow to President Mohamed Morsi and has drawn an angry response from the Islamists' leader's supporters in the Muslim Brotherhood. Seeking to keep pressure on Mr. Morsi, the main opposition coalition will now hold new protests against an Islamist-backed draft constitution that has divided Egypt. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Since Monday, five Pakistani polio vaccination workers have been killed in the country's largest city, Karachi. In the northern city of Peshawar, a 17-year-old girl died in hospital after being shot while supervising an anti-polio campaign. No group has claimed responsibility, but many Islamists and Muslim preachers have claimed that such a campaign is another Western plot to sterilise Muslims. Joining us on the line from Karachi to tell us more is Bilal Lakhani, journalist and academic. Bilal, welcome to Midori House. Bring us up to date with exactly what's happened over the past few days.
All right. What we're hearing right now in Karachi is that six polio workers have been shot dead who basically administrate polio drops to children by going door to door. And the deaths have occurred both in Karachi and in the northern areas. And this comes with a history of such incidents against polio workers. What's interesting about today's events is that they're not being discussed as much in Karachi or in Pakistan as they are in the international media. And this is interesting because there seems to be a sense of outrage fatigue that seems to have hit people in Pakistan. Just recently, there was an audacious attack on the Peshawar airport, where militants tried to overtake the airport as a whole. And really, violence in Karachi in terms of the number of deaths that have been occurring is routinely exceeding a dozen people a day. So when the news of six polio workers being shot dead made the rounds in Karachi and in Pakistan, it really did not spark such a big conversation. But what's interesting now is that we're seeing a lot of international media pick up on this news, whereas there isn't a lot of local media pickup and discussion on this. So this is what we're seeing right now on the ground in Pakistan. Of course, to give you some history and background on the attacks themselves, religious militants and Islamic militants in particular have been claiming for some time that these polio vaccinations indeed make Muslim men impotent, and that this is part of a Western conspiracy to hold back, Muslim populations in Pakistan.
And on that issue, how widespread is that view throughout Pakistan that that's what these vaccinations are all about?
In urban Pakistan, this is not a widely held view. In rural Pakistan, particularly in northern areas where the Pashtuns are, this seems to be gaining currency at gunpoint, literally at gunpoint, because that's what the militants are propagating, and they're literally banning government officials and polio vaccination officials from going and administrating this vaccination. However, it's important to note that when there was a raid on Osama bin Laden's compound last year in May, there was a health official who did go to the OBL compound to administer a health vaccine, and what he was actually doing was trying to obtain DNA samples from bin Laden's home. And this is actually used as an incident by militants and by people who propagate this theory to establish that their fears are not uncalled for, that this is indeed used by Western intelligence agencies to achieve their own ends. And they also particularly say that this is not just used to make men impotent, but also to gather intelligence, in these remote tribal areas. And this is linked, of course, to drone attacks, which occur in northern areas in Pakistan. And the intelligence for that, militants argue, comes from vaccination drives like this.
On the issue of how serious polio is in Pakistan, it's one of really only three countries where the disease is still endemic. And the government was targeting 33 million children for vaccination here. They've sent 88,000 health workers across the country to try and administer these vaccinations. What are these attacks going to do for that program? Is the government still promising to plow ahead?
For now, the government has suspended the program for the next 3 days, but the government really has no choice but to continue this program. Otherwise, it risks an even severe epidemic than the one that Pakistan is already under the grips of. So the government must continue this. The question is, how will it guarantee security for workers who want to continue to do this? And will there be a public narrative that will counter the militant narrative to this? And will civil society really rally around and help the government, to make its case on the importance of polio vaccination? So it's going to be very interesting to see if there is a real change in narrative and if people do stand up and take a stand for polio vaccinations and against the militants. So that's the million-dollar question about whether we're going to see a change in narrative or not.
Indeed. Bilal Lakhani in Karachi, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Next up, we're going to be hearing how Darjeeling tea is protecting itself from imitators. Stay with us.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
This Christmas, Monocle 24 is packing its earmuffs, mittens, sticks and skis as we head up the Alps to sunny St Moritz for a winter retreat. We'll be bringing you a Christmas stocking full of shows, including The Briefing, Midori House and The Review. So join our editors and their guests for a festive spree of friends and family, debate and discussion with plenty of mulled wine. From Boxing Day all the way to New Year's Day 2013, right here on Monocle 24.
It's 18:12 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Champagne is from champagne, cognac is from cognac, Melton Mowbray pies are from, well, Melton Mowbray. So three guesses where Darjeeling is from. Except actually, until now, it could have been from anywhere. After years of being mixed and blended with various other tea leaves, resulting in often lower quality versions, Darjeeling will now have protection from imitators. It recently won a legal battle with both the World Trade Organization and the European Union to phase out mixed Darjeeling teas, and also for the region to receive recognition for producing it. To tell us more about this, I'm joined in the studio by tea expert Tim Duffet from Postcard Teas here in London. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you have been to Darjeeling yourself. Before we talk about the tea, tell us about the area and what it's like.
It's a magical area in the northeast of India, bordering on to Nepal. A lot of the companies who own the estates have offices in Calcutta, which was the previous capital of India. So it's steeped in a lot of history, steeped in a lot of colonial history, but since 1950 or so, most of the companies have been Indian-owned, and they're either operated by families or by corporations, or in some cases by cooperatives.
And tell us about the tea itself. What is it that makes Darjeeling, the proper Darjeeling, special?
We have to go back a little bit to history. The British were buying so much tea from China that they were thinking of different ways that they could supply their tea habit. And one of the ways they could do that was by taking teas or tea trees from China, in fact, stealing them and taking them to Darjeeling. And Darjeeling was one of the few places where Chinese tea plants work particularly well. So you've got this amazing combination between the area or terroir of Darjeeling, the soil, the climate, these particular floral and fragrant Chinese tea bushes, and the remarkable people that make it. So those kind of combinations make a truly special tea.
And how big is the industry there now? I mean, in terms of sort of the numbers people employ or the amount of tea that it actually produces?
I'm going to give you rough
ideas. That's quite right.
There have been up until various times about 80 estates. Estates can vary from about 100 to 200 acres up to about 1,000 acres or so. Most of them have lots of jungle and are sometimes not completely usable because there are very steep slopes. So they tend to be large estates with up to 1,000 people living and working on them. And they produce on average between 100,000 and maybe up to 1 million kilos a year per estate. And they produce from late February, March through till around about October, November.
Okay. And so, as we were saying, a lot of the Darjeeling that's been drunk around the world is not necessarily all from Darjeeling.
And absolutely.
So it's been mixed with other teas.
But this is typical anyway with lots of teas around the world. Even famous Japanese teas are allowed by law. There's a very famous area in Japan called Uji, and you can call a tea an Uji tea if it has 51% or so of tea from Uji. So this is a big problem. I think the EU is great to recognise the protected designation of origin of Darjeeling, but it should also look at the labelling, because if you go into a normal store and buy a tea from a supermarket, even fair trade or organic teas, you'll see very few really in-depth detailing of where it comes from, and that's something which I think the EU needs to look at.
So with this change, what does that then mean for Darjeeling? When I pick up a box of it myself, what am I going to be getting in it?
Well, hopefully it will mean it's protected by law that it has to be 100% Darjeeling tea. At the moment, because people can blend it to save money, Darjeeling's often command much higher prices than Nepali teas, which are very close to it, because, as I mentioned, it's right on the border with Nepal, and most of the workers there are Gurkhas. In fact, there's a separatist movement in Darjeeling. But they're often blended with Nepali teas or teas from elsewhere, and then that's sold as a Darjeeling. So the great thing about it would be that Darjeeling estates and all the workers there will get more protection, hopefully more money, because I've read that sometimes as much as times four of the amount sold as Darjeeling is not Darjeeling. So
yeah,
only a quarter of what is marked as Darjeeling really is Darjeeling.
Does this also mean, therefore, that there's going to be less Darjeeling on the shelves, because there's if you're not mixing it with other teas, then there's going to be less of it to buy?
Possibly. I mean, if it's honestly labelled, my company...
Yeah, let's talk about the teas that Darjeeling that you do.
I bought in a Darjeeling that we do, which is from a cooperative, not an estate, in Darjeeling. But since 2008, when we think we became the first tea company in the world to break down every blend, every tea, every single tea we sold, whether it was single origin or a blend, into where it came from, we had to put the maker's name or the farm, plus the area, plus the country. We'd like to see something like that all over. That would protect Darjeeling, which is getting protection under this, but it would also tell you where they came from. And the other great thing is that if Darjeeling, in one sense, decreases, you've got a chance to go to other areas like Nepal, which produces great teas too.
Timothy DeFay from Postcard Teas, thank you very much indeed for coming in.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Alpino, Monocle's winter newspaper, landed with a satisfying thud, just like that, on our desks here at Midori House this week. And it will be with you on newsstands tomorrow. Our senior editor, Sophie Grove, has been donning her fur hat in pursuit of icy climbs and a good story. And she joins me in the studio now to discuss her Alpino report from Iceland. Hello, Sophie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Quite all right. Thank you for popping in. Now, Alpino, I got to go to the Arctic Circle. You got to go to Iceland. We had a little bit of a, not a row, but
maybe
like
a flip of the coin.
Yeah, as to who was going to go where. I'm quite happy with where I went. But tell us about Iceland as I flick open.
Flick open the beautiful story, actually. I mean, it is a stunning looking place. But I was revisiting Iceland because since 2008, when the financial collapse happened there, we've been back twice and we've met various different people. And I went to sort of see how they were getting on and do some more research on other things as well, further
yes,
to
not,
that.
Not just catching up with our old friends.
But it's really fascinating to look at the trajectory of those people. For instance, one man we met had lost his job at a car dealership. Then he went into tourism because tourism got a boost when the krona fell because it was so much cheaper. And now he's moved into the film sector. So he's working with Ridley Scott. And that's quite astonishing because since the crisis, lots of Hollywood film houses have started to take advantage of some of the tax breaks that the government have cleverly put their way, and also the beautiful, beautiful ethereal landscape and 24-hour light in summer to film. So he's been working on four blockbusters in the last summer. It's just really interesting to see how people are sort of, making the best out of what, frankly, was a complete disaster for their economy.
And how much does this work as a model or a template for other European countries that have had experienced similar economic problems? Obviously, Iceland had an advantage in a way in that it wasn't in the euro, so it could devalue the krona. It also chose, unlike Ireland, where the state took over the banks and took on the banks' debts, Iceland let its banks just go bankrupt. So there are two key things there which no one else has done. But are there other things that other good lessons?
Well, funnily enough, the IMF has just published a report saying that it is actually an interesting and good case study to emulate, mainly because the Icelandic sort of strategy was to safeguard society and not make the people pay for the mistakes of the bank. Even though people went bankrupt, they had their debts written off and then they started again. They haven't had the social impact, that absolute pain that we've seen in Spain and Greece, for instance. So they have got a good thing going on, but at the same time, they're in fiscal limbo, as I said in the piece, because they've got capital controls, which means you really can't, it's not a real economy yet, because they can't, if you're Icelandic, for instance, you can't even take money out of the country on holiday, or to a certain degree anyway. So you, in a way, that's boosted the local economy, and that's what we've seen. So there are all these companies that started after these people lost their jobs in 2008, and they're actually flourishing in Reykjavik, and they have curious things like cycle shops. We met somebody 4 years ago who set up a bike shop. Now he has five bike shops in Reykjavik. It's absolutely booming. People are buying bikes for thousands of euros and cycling like they never did before. And you're seeing that, but at the same time, I met so many people who were suffering so much just because they'd taken all of these mixed loan currency loans and they were still sort of worrying about their houses. If they did happen to have property, it was still, a huge burden around their necks. So it's not all rosy, it has to be said.
I was talking to an artist recently who'd been in Iceland for a few days, and he'd been in a small town outside Reykjavik in a car with a friend there, an Icelandic friend, and as they came up to the traffic lights, which were green, he slowed down and said, look at the traffic lights, look at the top one. as it went from green to red, the red traffic light wasn't a light. It was a red heart. My friend was like, what is that? What happened? And he said, well, there was this little old lady who thought maybe we should put stencils around the traffic lights, turn them into hearts. And she went to the city council and said, we should do this. And the council said, yeah, all right.
It
sounds like it's a sort of place where you can do odd and curious different things.
It is. I mean, I haven't seen any of them, it has to be said, but everyone knows everyone. I mean, you can just go down and meet the Prime Minister quite easily, as everyone reminded me. These people can make business happen. It's quite interesting that they are really innovating. There are mad things happening now with the geothermal energy. We went to some of these big power plants, and it turns out that their biggest one, they're turning into a fish farm next door where they're going to be farming Senegalese sole.
Wow.
So you can see that they're trying to diversify, they're trying to innovate, and the whole country is behind that. So, you know, even though there's a bleak picture, there is definitely an intriguing scope for change.
And also some fantastic photos there from Rama Knight, including probably the most Icelandic people you could possibly find.
And attractive. They all seem to be in hand-knitted jumpers, which they are wearing, but they do look rather stunning. And we've got some fascinating pictures of, you know, these local cafes that have sprung up. The aesthetics changed in Iceland. That's the really interesting thing. It's no longer slick. It's no longer this kind of aspirational. It's much more cosy. There's a knitting revival. People are eating the local dishes again, such as fermented shark.
Fermented shark. There we are. You can see all that and read all that in the new issue of Alpino. It's on newsstands from tomorrow. If you're a subscriber, you've probably got it all already. Sophie Grove, thank you very much indeed. Now, it's nearly Christmas. We're going to play some Christmas music in a bit. That's later on. My second favourite Christmas song of all time we're going to play. But first, this is beautiful. It's LCD Sound System, New York, I Love You.
New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. Like a rat in a cage, pulling minimum wage. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. New York, you're safer, and you're wasting my time. Records all show you were filthy but fine, but they shuttered your stores when you opened the doors to the cops who were bored once they'd run out of crime. New York, you're perfect, oh please don't change a thing. Your mild billionaire mayor's now convinced he's a king. And so the boring collect, I mean all disrespect. In the neighborhood bars I'd once dreamt I would drink. New York, I love you, but you're freaking me out. There's a ton of the twist, but we're fresh out of shout. Like a death in the hall that you hear through your wall. New York, I love you, but you're freaking me out. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. I love you, but you're bringing me down. Like a death of the heart. Jesus, where do I start? you're still the one pool where I'd happily drown.
That was New York, I Love You by the brilliant LCD Sound System. In the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be hearing from Zurich's Singing Christmas Tree. Oh, yes. And we'll also be joined in the studio by our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Liv Lewichnik, to discuss the year that was. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the headlines.
Five female Pakistani polio vaccination workers have been shot dead in attacks in Karachi and Peshawar. The victims were working with a UN-backed programme to eradicate polio, which is endemic in Pakistan. The Taliban has previously threatened to disrupt the scheme. South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party, the ANC, has re-elected President Jacob Zuma as its leader, setting him up for another 7 years as head of state. More than 4,000 ANC delegates erupted into wild cheers when Mr. Zuma was confirmed in the top party post after comfortably seeing off a challenge by Deputy President Kgalema Motlanthe. The rand edged higher against the dollar after the announcement, reflecting relief among investors in Africa's biggest economy at the likelihood of policies remaining largely unchanged. US President Barack Obama has met officials to discuss their response to the Connecticut massacre. The White House says reforming gun laws will be complex. 20 children and 6 teachers were killed by a lone gunman on Friday. The rape of a 23-year-old woman in a city bus in the Indian capital New Delhi has sparked outrage across Indian society from women activists, politicians and students. The medical student was gang-raped on Sunday night and was later thrown out of the moving vehicle in a semi-naked condition. Police said on Tuesday they had arrested 4 suspects, including the bus driver, in connection with the rape. The other suspects have been identified from CCTV footage. The Iraqi president Jalal Talabani has been taken to hospital after suffering a stroke. Government sources say he's in a critical but stable condition. Mr. Talabani, a Kurd who's mediated among Shiite, Sunni and Kurdish parties, is seen as an influential peacemaker who often eased tensions in the fragile power-sharing government and negotiated in rifts over oil between Baghdad and the OPEC member countries' autonomous Kurdistan region. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Monocle 24. It's 18:32 here in London. It is possibly the smallest but most beautiful Christmas market in Europe. And in the middle of Zurich's Wertmüllerplatz Christmas market, there stands an unusual Christmas tree. There's a gigantic wooden pyramid, which fits up to 120 singers in red woolen hats and green capes, singing their newest interpretations of pop classics, rock and traditional Christmas songs. For the 15th anniversary of Zurich's Singing Christmas Tree, Monocle's Manon Spindler popped in to find out more.
My name is André Kaufmehl. I'm original as professional lawyer, But I grew up with music, and I'm building platform for kids singing, and this I'm doing more than 20 years ago. So that's why I founded and organized this Singing Christmas Tree in Zurich.
We are here just behind the Zurich Bahnhofstrasse, and for people who haven't seen a singing Christmas tree yet, can you explain what it looks like?
It's a kind of building where we have installed a lot of platforms, seven in the height of 7 meters also. It's a pyramid, and this the whole platform is covered by trees which are really looking like a big, big Christmas tree.
And when did you start with the singing Christmas tree, and what's the idea behind it?
The original idea is coming from the United States, where they have it in the churches, and a few of them, they are also for only a few days in the public, outside, outdoor. But they came about 18 years ago, all the magazine from the big shops came to ask me if I could do something like this. We started this. Installation is unique, you can't find them somewhere else. It's really the biggest one, I think. So it stays out 30 days a year in December. When it snows and it rains, we always sing.
I'm here with Caroline of the Zurich Soul and Gospel Choir. How is it to sing in this tree?
It's amazing. You have such a lot of people sitting around looking at you, and especially with the snow, it's actually just a really nice feeling.
And how is it when you sing on the top position? Is it important that you're not afraid of heights?
I think in the beginning maybe it's a little bit scary, but you're such getting in a feeling while you're like clapping in your hands and dancing and singing, so at the end you don't even realize that you're up there.
And what are you going to sing tonight?
We do have Hallelujah that we're going to sing. We do have A Smile, and then Lord Hold Me. So I'm really excited, and I hope I'm crossing the fingers and everything is going to be right.
And it's really very beautiful with all the lights, and it's huge. How many meters tall is it, and how many people fit in there?
The top is 7 meters, and we have these seven platforms, where in total we have about 80 adults, or we can have 120 kids who can sing on the tree.
And what singers or chorals are coming this year to sing in the Singing Christmas Tree?
Normally we invite school classes. We tell them, listen, if you do something for Christmas time, you can come and celebrate here on the tree. You can make your big party here. And of course, over the weekend, we don't have the kids more or less there. We go for adults, for soul and gospel choirs. So it's a mixture between pop, rock and silent night.
And the tree belongs to this smallest and most beautiful Christmas market in Europe. Can you tell me more about the market?
When we got this place here, we realized there's a big space only for singing. It's too big, so the town asked us to build also a market. But then we built up for only food. We have six small huts, and we celebrate here original Swiss food, which is Glühwein, cheese, which Bratwurst. We do have everything which is really coming from Switzerland. Also, we are selling soups. And yeah, it's really beautiful. We are like a big family on a small, nice place.
And what's the highlight tonight? Who is going to sing tonight?
It depends what you expect. Normally people are coming and they want to see the kids. So we had them just before. Now the next half an hour, we have a soul and gospel choir, which is, I would say, almost professionals and really great singers they have. And it's a highlight what we have tonight.
And that was Manon Spindler and a singing Christmas tree. There we are. Up next, as if you thought this show couldn't get any stranger, we're going to be talking about Vegemite. Yes, we really, really are. You're listening to Midori House.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off-piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Just a few days ago here at Midori House, London's finest foreign correspondents descended on Monocle HQ for a Christmas tipple or two. Much mulled wine was drunk. Monocle's Adrian Craddock was there to mingle with our guests and discuss some of the bigger news stories on their radar. Here he is talking to Garth Bray from New Zealand public radio, public TV. See it as a sort of an Anzac double act.
What do you think has been the biggest, most important story in New Zealand for 2012?
I think 2011 was such a hard year for a lot of Kiwis with the earthquakes in Christchurch. And 2012 has really been about how they've tried to come back from that and how hard it has been. And we've seen how difficult it is to try and reconstruct, you know, a city of close to 500,000 people in the developed world with all the problems that that has, with all the lives that it touches. And I guess that's been the one that's bubbled under, I think, through a lot of things.
So overall, do you think that 2012 was a good year or a bad year for New Zealand?
Well, someone once said Australia is a quarry with a view. New Zealand's like just a great big field where a bunch of cows live, and in a sense, you know, we feed the world. And the world's still a hungry place, and China's still really hungry, and they're prepared to pay a lot of money. So in that sense, I guess things haven't been as bad as you might imagine, and things have kind of kept bubbling along. And as long as that carries on, you know, it'll take the edge off a lot of the problems that I think a lot of the rest of the world's seeing.
As far as the UK goes, I mean, you're obviously based in the UK. How do you feel that 2012, has the perception of the UK changed in New Zealand, do you think, after the Olympics?
I think it's always had quite a fond perception for a lot of New Zealanders. There's still enough people that are of a generation that remember it somewhat as home, or they have a strong connection to it. They're pretty comfortable. I think probably they saw the best of the UK this year. It'll be really interesting to see how that picture changes next year without all the bright, sparkly lights of, you know, your Royal Jubilee or the Olympics especially, because there are some pretty, you know, ill, chill winds blowing through. But I think for a lot of people, they would have seen a country that they kind of fondly remember.
And if you could look in your crystal ball for a moment, what do you think is going to be the big story of 2013 for New Zealand? Is there anything that's on your radar?
Wow, gee, I guess I'm posted here, so I'm more interested in what is happening here that might affect them. That's such a good question.
Anything come to mind?
Are
you going to pass on that one?
Yeah, I'm going to pass. I'm sorry, man. I'm going to phone a friend and ask him. Yeah, I don't know. Look, you're a year out from an election. It's things are going to muddle on, I think. Oh, the America's Cup. They're going to hold the America's Cup in San Francisco, and if New Zealand wins that, that'll be a big boost for them.
Also, I mean, one of the other things that I've been asking around a lot of the correspondents today is, one of the big stories, obviously, of 2012 was Obama's re-election. Do you think that was a positive story for New Zealand? Do you think that that will affect New Zealand in any way compared to your problem you got in?
Yeah, I don't know. It's always so hard to tell. I think probably continuity serves best, because people, certainly in Wellington, where I spent a lot of my time in New Zealand, had forged quite close links. They'd re-engaged with America in a way. There'd been quite a long period of disengagement and a lot of barriers there. So I guess some bridges have been built again, and a new administration maybe makes it difficult to sort of see that working as well. So it's probably positive.
Just finally, I saw some weird story recently about Marmite in New Zealand. Have you seen this? Apparently,
the shortage.
Exactly. Right. Apparently, after the earthquake, one of Sanitarium's factories were damaged, and there's been a shortage of Marmite ever since. Is that something that seems to be a big issue calling home? Is anyone been getting in contact with you? You know, apparently it's about to come back on the shelves.
I had to FedEx a jar of Marmite back to a colleague of mine who was then hankering.
Are you being serious?
I'm not. No, I am. Completely serious. I don't know. I don't know. What's a jar of Marmite? About £2. What's the FedEx bill on an urgent package? You could have bought a lot of Marmite for that Marmite. I think it was for a story. Look, you're an Australian, mate. I've always been a Vegemite guy.
That ended rather abruptly, didn't it? It's Marmite. It's got to be Marmite all the way, not Vegemite. That was Adrian Craddock speaking to Garth Bray from Television New Zealand. Now, I promised you my second favourite Christmas song of all time. I might play my first favourite at some stage before Christmas, I'm sure. But this is rather special, I think. It's The Waitresses with Christmas Wrapping.
Magic's brought this tale to a very happy ending.
That was The Waitresses with Christmas Wrapping. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 1951 in Rome, 1851 here in London. Now, it is Christmas, as you know, as everyone knows by now. And at Christmas time, we like to bring all our bureau chiefs, all our editors, many of our correspondents back to London, back to Midori House for a few Christmas parties, bits and bobs, and we thought while they're here, we'll also drag them into the studio to give them a bit of time to take stock and mull over the year that was in their patch. And today we're joined in the studio by our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Liv Lewichnik. Liv, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you very much.
Now, it's been, first of all, before we get on to what's been happening in Hong Kong this year, Christmas in Hong Kong, how do they do it?
Well, I would say Christmas in Hong Kong is done basically like here in London, like in the UK, like in Sweden. I'm
like
Swedish.
Like well, yours is obviously very different.
I suppose it's quite different than that. But, you know, you have the Christmas decorations and you have the big family get-togethers and so on.
Excellent. And you're going to be in Sweden for your Christmas.
That's right.
And that's very different again, isn't it?
Yeah, snowy.
Snowy. Yeah, of course. Excellent. Yeah, no snow in Hong Kong and no snow, it seems, in London. Although you never know, that might change. Now, let's look at Hong Kong's year. There's been, obviously, we've talked a lot about the change of leadership in China on the mainland, but there's also been a change of leadership in Hong Kong itself. Donald Tsang, the former chief executive, has gone. He's been replaced by CY Leung. What sort of changes have actually happened so far? Have you noticed much of a transition?
Well, there's been a lot of debate around the new chief executive, CY Leung. So I would say that most of the focus has been on that. He's not very well liked among Hong Kongers. So that's a bit of a problem for him. He's widely seen as a Beijing stooge, very pro-Beijing. And people are worried that he's looking to implement sort of pro-China policies in Hong Kong.
How much does that matter if he's not popular? Since, you know, there's not really a, you know, we're not talking about a democratic state.
Absolutely.
Does it really, you know, are there things that he therefore cannot do if he doesn't feel he has popular support?
I think he does need popular support, though. Even though you're absolutely right in saying that it's not a democratic system, but it's, of course, very, very important that he is, you know, well received and well liked among the Hong Kong population. Some of the, you know, more populist policies that he talked about even during his election campaign, you know, banning mainland Chinese mothers from giving birth in Hong Kong, for example. He's also talked about social housing and building more affordable housing for Hong Kong, which is popular, of course, because housing is a huge issue in Hong Kong. Space overall is a huge issue and it probably always will be. So that's one good thing that he's, you know, he's discussing, debating. But the other things that sort of overshadow those better things that he's talking about, the issues about him, for example, having an illegal basement at home. And during the election campaign, he even criticised his election rival.
Sorry, he has an illegal basement.
Yes, so
explain to me what an illegal basement is.
Well, you have to, you're not allowed to build, you know, extensions and things like that at home. Even putting up extra fences and things like that in your garden, there are very strict rules in place, and you have to go to the building department to get a permit to do this, of course. Apparently this basement existed in his house when he moved in, and then he decided to board it up and not report it to the building department. But this has got him into a lot of trouble because he criticized his election rival for having an illegal basement at home. So now he's in a lot of trouble for that. So, you know, these kinds of issues really overshadow any sort of good policies that he's, or progressive, I should say, progressive policies that he's trying to implement.
I must say, if a political scandal comes down to illegal basements and who has them, then maybe things aren't too bad. Having said that, one thing that certainly isn't good at the moment is issues over media freedom in Hong Kong. Obviously, the media has far more freedom in Hong Kong than it does in mainland China. But some of these freedoms appear to be under threat now.
Well, as you just said, you know, much more media freedom in Hong Kong than on the mainland. But we have seen during this year Hong Kong journalists being arrested on the mainland, and also criticisms over, you know, closer to home, editors at, for example, the South China Morning Post and other media outlets being criticized over self-censorship and not being able to report, some of them even resigning because they haven't been able to report on issues that are critical of China or of the Beijing authorities. Another issue or another example, a new radio station, DBC, which was on air just for 1 month, was taken off air because a lot of the journalists who work there, they say, you know, it's because the presenters and the producers that they'd hired were, you know, against or too much critical or too critical of Beijing.
And is there much that people can do about this? I mean, is there, you know, enough civil society in Hong Kong that's powerful enough to make a stand against this and try and reverse some of those trends?
I think so. Yes, there's a strong, you know, civic people care about these issues and debate them and talk about them. I think it's quite different to if we look at the mainland issue. People, yes, you have the blogosphere and people talking about it there, but I think people have a different sense of despair there, that it's very, very difficult for them to actually see anything change. Whereas in Hong Kong, I do feel that people are confident that they can do something about it. Although, of course, they're fighting a bit of an uphill battle, of course, and these are really worrying trends that we've seen of the past year, and it's obviously something that's, you know, Hong Kongers are extremely proud of their media freedoms, just as they're proud of their independence from mainland China. So,
one more issue I just want to touch on here, and I think we'll leave the disputes in between Japan and China and so on for another time. Let's talk about maids, which doesn't sound like a big geopolitical issue, but it does really get to the core of some of these broader issues about residency within Hong Kong and who's Chinese and who's from Hong Kong. Summarise for us, if you can, how this story has played out over the past year.
Well, to go back to the issue of permanent residency and how that works. So foreigners who live and work in Hong Kong, they would normally get permanent residency status in Hong Kong after 7 years, which means that you can then use the city's healthcare and so on, and schooling, etc. And then we have these 300,000 maids, mostly from the Philippines and Indonesia, living and working in Hong Kong, you know, for years, and they haven't been able to get residency status up until November, actually, when a domestic worker from the Philippines, who's worked in Hong Kong for 26 years, she won a high court ruling that allows her to actually apply for permanent residency. A very welcome decision in the community, in the maid community, but also a lot of Hong Kongers are, you know, strongly against this.
Okay, well, we'll see how that plays out over the next 12 months. Liv Lewichnik, our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, thank you very much indeed. And that, I'm afraid, is that for today's edition of Midori House. Our producer was Dawn Trump. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Philly Lim. And our studio manager was Sam Impey. We'll be back in 3 hours' time with the Monocle Daily. Emma Nelson and Guy Delaunay will be your hosts for that. Emma will be back here for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for me, Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.